So this afternoon, my goal is to hopefully increase our group familiarity with a very precious epistle in the New Testament. And if you didn't understand my goals and my intentions, you might think that I was being argumentative, but that's not at all true. Okay. My goal is that you do remember the lesson, and I hope to maybe sharpen our focus. And as we look at this epistle, I don't know if this is a good goal or not, but I'm kind of hoping that I can sharpen our group focus on two of the chapters, the last two chapters. I want to focus on the last two chapters as opposed to all the other chapters that come before this. So I find this message rather pointed or sharp. Now, I don't mean what I'm going to say. I find that the author wrote it in a very sharp, pointed manner. And my suspicion is that those who received this letter, this original letter, had some misgivings. And I would say even maybe hurt feelings. And so we'll see how that strikes you. Now this writing is filled with many lessons. And this is my big point. But some of the lessons are more important than others. Okay, and I firmly believe that as we discuss any interesting and elaborate subject, we can get lost in the details and miss the major point. We can easily miss the major point because we get lost in some, so to speak, jot and tittle. So my goal is to come up with the one biggest point of this epistle. I see the book in two major parts, but they're not equal. I'm making a segregation of the two parts, but let the record show I'm not really discriminating against the other part. Okay. One is 85% of the epistle. The other is 15%. And you can get lessons from the 85%, but my suspicion is that that's in second place. I'm not going to disrespect the 85%. It definitely has lessons, but the 85% was basically written for another audience, another era, another part of the gospel age. And I believe that our priority is the 15%. It's the 15% that will change your life. The 85% is interesting. It's fun to argue about and debate. But the 15% changes your eternal destiny. The 15% is a matter of life and death. The book of Hebrews has always had a touch of mystery to it. Hence my title, The Mystery Epistle. Now, the first mystery, I would say, comes from the lack of definitive authorship. No author is mentioned. And if you look at so many of Paul's other writings, he will say, Paul, a messenger of Jesus Christ. Or he'll say, Paul and Timothy. Or he'll say, Paul and Silas. Or something like that. Not in this book. Not in this letter. It just starts out. Another point is that the scholars who understand Greek as a language, both written and spoken, literally, academically, they say that the words that are put together are unique. The style of writing is unique and different than any other epistle in the New Testament. And they make particular point that the style is different from all of Paul's other letters. Now, I can't verify that, not being Greek scholar. But I guess we could accept their analysis that there's something about the pen, not the penmanship, but the style of writing, the grammar that's unique about this book. Hence, more mystery. Another mysterious point is that tradition says that no one in the early years of the church, all the records from the 100s, the 200s, men like Origen, who wrote, but they did not believe that the Apostle Paul had anything to do with this letter. And the Apostle Paul is, of course, the first suspect that we have all these other writings in the New Testament. And then here's another one called the Book to the Hebrews. But they did not, in that time era, think that Paul had anything to do with it. We also don't know, we don't even know what city this was written to. It was written to the Hebrews. Jerusalem is an option, but so is Alexandria. Jerusalem had the largest group, but Alexandria had the second largest group. So authors have been suggested like Barnabas. Barnabas was from Cyprus. Cyprus had a strong relationship with Alexandria. Some say it was Apollos. Some people say it's Timothy that wrote it. We can't be sure. We can be confident that the epistle was accepted as worthwhile early on in the gospel age. It survived through the ages, and we believe it edifies us. The one thing that I'm pretty sure of is that this was one tough message. And as I mentioned before, I think the possibility greatly exists that the recipient maybe didn't like this message at all. That's my guess. This is not exactly a love letter. Even though there is a statement of I love you in it, boy, there's some tough ideas here. And this author really challenged some of the recipient's deep-seated and favorite beliefs. He goes down one after the other and kind of attacks them. Now, why does he bother to attack them? Why is this important to him? He felt they were barriers. It's a little bit like you can't serve God and mammon. You got to take a choice. And he felt that they were obstacles to the Christian walk, hindrances, weights dragging them down. They were diversions. They were taking them off course. And of course, we immediately wonder if that was happening back 2,000 years ago, would that same phenomenon be taking place today? Can we get so involved in other discussions, other technicalities, other things that we love to debate and start missing the more important things in our lives? I think the author of Hebrews thought that concept or that behavior was a problem. There were multiple issues that he brings up. First of all, he takes on the angels. Oh, that's a little bit of a surprise, and it adds to the mystery. I personally didn't know that the Jews had a problem with angels. I had no idea historically how enamored the Jews were with angels. And I recommend you Google Jewish angels history, something like that, and you will see reference after reference as to what the Jews believe, what they had reverence for, and how obsessed they were with angel thinking. They loved angels. Everything was explained through angels. There was nothing that could happen that couldn't be explained by an angel. If it was weather, it was an angel. If it was the crop growing, agriculture, it was an angel. Good news, it was an angel. Bad news, it was an angel. Indigestion, it was an angel. And the rabbis who were supposed to be the source of all information and the fountain of knowledge, they would frequently say, documented, it was the angels. Everything had an angel. One well-documented belief was that every blade of grass had its own angel. Yeah, yeah. Every blade of grass had its own individual angel. Oh, how they loved the angels. Now, was this a problem? Well, yeah, because some people were saying back then that Jesus was an angel. Well, that doesn't work. Jesus had to be a man. The man Christ Jesus. He had to be a man to be the ransom for Adam, not an angel. But you can see when you think of his miracles and the things he did and the power and resurrection, the angel idea kind of fits. And it definitely was one of the explanations. But the author here, chapter 1, he says in verse 1 through 3, he says that God, who gave our forefathers many different glimpses of the truth in the words of the prophets, this is Phillips, has now, at the end of the present age, given us the truth in the Son. In verse 4, he says, talking about Jesus, he says, thus proving himself, Jesus, by the more glorious name that he has won, far greater than all the angels of God. Verse 14, does he ever say this of any of the angels, quote, sit at my right hand? Surely the angels are no more than spirits. That's a quote from Phillips. Surely the angels are no more than spirits in the service of God, commissioned to serve the heirs of God's salvation. I mean, that's, if you're an angel fan, boy, that's pretty strong language. You're not going to like that. Attributing everything to the angels also interferes with the working of the Holy Spirit. What we would say is Jehovah's Spirit working in our lives, they would attribute to angels. Say, well, is that such a bad idea, angels? Well, it's a diversion. It's taking us away from Jesus Christ. And a couple, the second chapter goes on for some more quotes. The second chapter, verse 5, it was not to the angels that God subjected the world to come. Again, imagine if angels were your favorites. You'd be a little put off by that opening, wouldn't you? So, not terribly wrong, but diversionary. Another problem was the high priest and the priesthood. They loved the high priest. It was the visible head of their religion. Yahweh, they couldn't see him. Jesus, they couldn't see him. But they knew where the high priest lived. Yeah, the high priest was in Jerusalem. They knew where his house was. He was like their pope. And like the pope, there were good popes and there were bad popes. There were good high priests, there were bad high priests. Did the high priest outrank Jesus? Yeah, in some people's mind, kind of, he was there in Jerusalem. Jesus was gone. And you know, Jesus was not from the priestly tribe. He didn't come from Levi. And in some respects, that gave the high priest, in some people's eyes, perhaps some authority, some stature. Oh, they loved the high priest. A lot of them did. They loved his breastplate, his hat. And this is basically person worship. And as the author goes on, he picks out other persons that they worshiped. They worshiped Moses. They worshiped Abraham. You remember how the Pharisees said, our father Abraham.
And we forget to go back.
Worshiped Joshua. And this interfered with their Christian growth. It made them stuck back in the same old place. So the author, one by one, he shatters these icons, and these deeply rooted beliefs are just destroyed. Take Moses for an example. We all like Moses, right? He was a terrific person. But the author of Hebrews, with only a slight nod to what Moses does, he really puts him down. And in a nice, kind of a nice way, he says he did a good job, but it was servant work. Third chapter, fifth verse, servant. Now, in those days of writing, they really used the word slave. They didn't have servants. They had slaves. So he said, Moses did a good job, but it was the work of a slave. Ooh, ouch. He said, Moses did slave work in the house. Jesus Christ, as the Son, was in charge of the house. From these ideas of people worship, in the fourth chapter, all the way through eighth, the author takes on the priesthood and what the priests did. And it was mostly a Levite issue. And you know, Jesus wasn't even from the priestly class. And there was that bombshell story of Melchizedek's story, and they loved Abraham so much, we follow our father Abraham. And here they're told that your father just paid tithes to Melchizedek. And then from people worship, we move to chapters 9 and 10. And the author takes on the temple and the temple system. Now, as a building, there is no building that could have surpassed the temple for beauty. I don't think anywhere in the entire Roman Empire. It was awesome in the full sense of awe. It had been remodeled by Herod the Great, and he built a huge courtyard around the sanctuary. They say it was something like 9 football fields put together. The building stones weighed tons. The Jews loved this building. They had annual festivals there, Passover, Pentecost. Millions, they say even millions, people, a million people would come. Day of Atonement. And don't think for a minute that just because they became Christians, they forgot all their holidays. No, they liked that. You know, we have to admit, they didn't have a lot of entertainment, and the temple was quite a show. They had music, they had singing, they had pageantry, parades, the trumpets would blow, organs would play, cymbals would crash, drums. Where else could you see a show like that? And sometimes they say that what makes a movie popular is that there's bloodshed in it. Well, guess what? The temple had blood and gore too. They killed animals there, and it's pretty exciting stuff. And besides the entertainment, you could even eat at the temple. They had dining rooms around the outside. They had food and meals right there. How could you touch that? Well, you know what the author says? He says it was all over. He says, forget about those temple sacrifices. It was replaced, chapter 9, verse 26, by the one-time sacrifice of Jesus. He sacrificed himself once and for all. This was the final solution for sin. In chapter 10, I think it's verse 1, the author says that the entire temple system was a hint of what was to come. You know what a hint is? A hint is so small you can hardly, it's like if I give you a hint that I love you, if it's only a hint, that's not saying very much. He said that entire temple system was only a hint. So listen to some of these words. 7th chapter, verses 13, verses 18 from Phillips. There is a definite cancellation of the previous commandment because of its ineffectiveness and uselessness oh my gosh, he's talking about what they used to do and what some of them were still doing. Can you imagine? I mean, just personalize it. Say one of our conventions or your discourse is called ineffective and useless. And in chapter 7, verse 13, this is now from the Message Bible. There is no way of understanding this in terms of the old Levitical priesthood. Is that interesting? There is no way of understanding this in terms of the old Levitical priesthood. It's a mystery because we spend a lot of time studying the old Levitical priesthood and we extract lessons from it. But I'm wondering about our priorities. Verse 18, the former way of doing things, a system of commandments that never worked out the way it was supposed, was set aside. Chapter 10, verse 4. The plain fact is that bull and goat blood can't get rid of sin. So he has shattered a huge section of the old Jewish belief system. Now, has he been working anything else in as he's doing this? Well, sure. Starting at the beginning, chapters 1 and 2, he starts off by saying the Son is higher than the angels. In chapter 3, verse 1, he says, take a hard look at Jesus. He is the centerpiece of everything. That should be underlined. Chapter 9, verse 26, he sacrificed himself once and for all. The final solution of sin. Chapter 8, verse 6. Jesus' priestly work far surpasses what these other priests do. Now this brings us to chapter 12. The key word is therefore. Now what does therefore mean? I think it means something has happened, and now, therefore, you're supposed to go to the next step. Because what has gone before, you logically are implored to move to something else. Maybe it's a higher level, maybe it's a conclusion, some action. Therefore, you ate your vegetables, therefore, you can have dessert. You passed the exam. Therefore, you get your diploma. You did a great job on the interview. Therefore, you will be hired. The author says that the system throughout the Old Testament was a failure. He says it didn't work at all. He's emphatic. The concepts, the icons, he says they didn't work. Therefore, chapter 12. This is it. This is the big point he wants to make. I'm tempted to say that the beginning chapters are like introduction. They're introduction to those who want to walk the narrow way. Here's what he says. Message translation. Keep your eyes on Jesus. Second verse, study how he did it. I think that means especially the four gospel accounts. Study them forward, study them backwards. We're talking about Matthew, John, Luke, Mark, front to back, back to front, topically, chronologically, study how he did it. Verse 3. The author doesn't let up. Go over that story item by item. My suspicion is we do not study Jesus enough. We don't study the Gospels enough. We study other things that refer to the Gospels. No, that's not what it says here. Let me hold that in your mind and let me jump aside to back to the authorship and why I think that Paul has something to do with this letter. The Apostle Paul had a style in his letters. He would discuss something, and then frequently he would either say amen or he would say therefore. And then he would discuss what you're supposed to do. Therefore, Romans is a great example. 11 chapters of talking about the law and what's truly an Israelite indeed and the history of the Jews, etc. 11th chapter. And he gets to the 12th chapter in verse 12:1. What does he say? What's the first word? Therefore, my beloved brethren. Ephesians, 6 chapters. The first 3 chapters, he's discussing the issues and the problems of the day. He says then, prayer at the end of the 3rd chapter. We heard that earlier today. And then he starts with the 4th chapter, and it's a to-do list, 4, 5, and 6, what you're supposed to do with your consecrated life. The same thing happens here. 11 chapters of discussion. And then he says, therefore, and he gives you a consecration to-do list. Now, that's got Paul's signature written all over it. Now, if Paul, you know, I think of what the experts say about, well, this is not Paul's grammar and stuff. Okay, I think at least Paul dictated it. And somebody else maybe wrote it, and that's why the grammar looks different. Now, if you study Hebrews chapter 12 and chapter 13, you will see the action items. This will tell you what to do with your consecrated life. It's 12 and 13. It's really not in 7 and 8 and 2 and 3. And it's really not in the story of Melchizedek. It's not in those first 85%. I think the focus needs to be on chapters 12 and 13. I hope you'll do this exercise. Go through what the author says in 12 or 16. If you believe it's Paul, it's fine. If you believe it's someone, it's irrelevant. And put them into some groups. Something that's easy to remember. Something you can recall on a daily basis. Now, your list is going to be different than mine. It's going to be different than your wife's. It's going to be different than your brother's. I made a list from chapters 12 and 13 a couple years ago. And guess what? I made a list recently, and the list is different. Different groupings, same scriptures, but I kind of put them together so I can remember them effectively. So, this time, I came up with 3 major topics that I can extract from chapters 12 and 13. Now, number 1 is flat out Jesus, right? We just talked about those. I just read those scriptures from chapter 12, verses 2, 3. Focus on Jesus. Now, the next thing that the author talks about is receiving discipline. And This starts in verse 5. So 1, 2, 3, 4 are kind of about Jesus. And then he says, don't disrespect the discipline from God. He says, you know, he uses the analogy of parent and child. Parent loves the child. He's going to discipline them, correct them. And he says in verse 7, don't think it's punishment. Take it as training. And then the third category is by far the largest of 12 and 13. And in some respects, we could say it's about love. But it also could be said, one of the translators said, getting along with each other. It's pretty close to love. So in Hebrews 13:1, stay on good terms with each other, held together by love. I believe this is from the Message Bible. And in verse 14 in chapter 12, just before that, work at getting along with each other. See that love, fellowship, connection? This is number 3. Make sure no one gets left out of God's generosity. 12:15. Generosity, love, just like Jehovah gave his only begotten son, just like Jesus gave his life for his friends. Make sure your life is filled with generosity of all sorts. Keep a sharp eye out for weeds of bitter discontent. That's a jealousy issue, has no place in love. 13:2, be ready with a meal. That's hospitality. You see how he's making the to-do list? If you read this, you know what to do with your consecration. Hebrews 13:3, regard prisoners as if you were in prison with them. This is empathy. This is sympathy, empathy, feeling for other people when they're in a really tough situation. 13:4, honor marriage. 13:7, appreciate your pastoral leaders. Okay, within the brotherhood, we have respect for those that are guiding us. And finally, in Hebrews 13:18, he says, pray for us. That's part of the fellowship. That's part of the brotherhood. That's what I felt. I was prayed for. Now, we could stop right there. The first point is Jesus, and this is it, right? He's worked up, and he starts with chapter 12. Therefore, number 1, Jesus. Number 2, accept the disciplines of Jehovah. And number 3, love and express yourself to the brotherhood. There's 2 other side small points that don't fit there. I would say Hebrews 12:16 and 13:5 talk about material goods. 13:5, don't be obsessed with getting more material things. And 12:16, watch out for the Esau syndrome to satisfy your short-term appetites. You know what Esau was consumed with, his stomach. And then also there could be a fifth where in Hebrews 13:9, the Message Bible says, don't be lured away from Jesus by the latest speculations about him. So I think this is a word of warning about speculations. It's one thing to study, it's another thing to speculate. But the main points are Jesus, discipline from Jehovah, and living the life of love. And he tells you exactly what to do with hospitality, generosity, prayer, and empathy, things like that. So those were the real reasons that the author wrote this letter. I think that we need to have this point very strongly in our lives, this focus on Jesus. And this is how we get assisted in our path to the heavenly kingdom. I recommend that you let your mind play with these mystery aspects of this epistle. Think about, was it Paul? Was it Barnabas? Was it Apollos? Think about, was it Jerusalem or Alexandria? Think about the angels and that, but always let those thoughts take you to chapters 12 and 13. And don't be embarrassed or shy about your passion for Jesus Christ and keeping your eyes fixed on Jesus. That's my prayer for all of us. Thank you.